Okay, now, keep in mind the fact that, basically, the acetylcholinesterase and acetylcholine are substances that occur naturally in the brain, but by using radio waves to stimulate them, they can be used to block neural impulses, neural transmission, rather, between one nerve cell and another. Keep in mind the metaphor suggested by, I believe it's Mr. Deutsch, who said basically that it's like having too many cars on a freeway, that that the stimulation of the acetylcholinesterase can block the transmission of a nerve. Of a nerve impulse, rather, across a synapse, okay? Going back to where we controlled, Lawrence presents information here that there was, and keep in mind, this book was published in 1967, Lawrence presents information here that there was already by that time a generator transmitter which could, using radio waves, cause the excessive production of the neural transmitter and the subsequent blocking of the transmission of a nerve impulse across the synapse between nerve cells. Okay, again, synapse is a gap between nerve cells. There is already in use a small EDOM generator transmitter which can be concealed on the body of the person. Contact with this person, a casual handshake or even just a touch, transmits a tiny electronic charge plus an ultrasonic signal tone which for a short while will disturb the time orientation of the persons affected. Not so precise or predictable a tool as RHIC, it can nevertheless be a potent weapon for hopelessly confusing evidence in the investigation of a crime, as we shall see. Continuing. A little later, Lawrence writes, we have seen that radio transmission can definitely produce meaningful stimulation of the brain. For RHIC, the response need not be even as complex as those we have read about. All that is necessary is a simple neuromuscular twitch activated by radio. One of the few glimpses we have been given by the scientific community of the ultra-miniaturized radio muscle stimulators was announced quietly by Dr. Wen Xing Ko, last name H-S-I-U-N-G-K-O, of the Case Institute of Technology in Cleveland. He admitted that receivers the size of shirt buttons were in the experimental stage, unquote. Receivers that could be buried in muscles and used to stimulate them internally. Dr. Koh's admission to the technical press comes years after the RHIC technicians had placed such implants in operation for less worthy motives than his. Dr. Koh's experiments are related to the work that has been done in Europe for many years to stimulate artificial limbs. His announcement of the extent to which the equipment has been miniaturized is no surprise to the researcher of information on RHIC implantations. Now, accepting the feasibility of this, the radio part of RHIC, let us move on to the hypno aspect. If the subject is placed under hypnosis and mentally programmed to maintain a determination eventually to perform one specific act, perhaps, for example, to shoot someone, it is suggested thereafter each time a particular muscle twitches in a certain manner, which is then demonstrated by using the transmitter, he will increase this determination even more strongly. As the hypnotic spell is renewed again and again, he makes it his life's purpose to carry out this act until it is finally achieved. Thus are the two complementary aspects of RHIC joined to reinforce each other and perpetuate the control until such time as the controlled behavior is called for. This is done by a second session with the hypnotist giving final instructions. These might be reinforced with radio stimulation in more frequent cycles. They could even carry over the moments after the act to reassure calm behavior during the escape period, as in the case of Oswald, or to assure that one conspirator would not indicate he was aware of the co-conspirator's role or that he was even acquainted with him. This might serve to block so much as a mention of the other's name. So keep in mind that basically what they do is they, under hypnosis, they induce someone to perform an act, and then they place a small device in a muscle which, when in response to radio stimulation, causes that muscle to twitch. And every time that muscle twitches, that reinforces the person's will to perform the given action up until the time the person performs the action, okay? Keep in mind also that this was written in 1967, and I guess there's no place better than right here in the Santa Clara Valley, dubbed the Silicon Valley, the sort of center of the electronics industry. Would people be better aware of the tremendous work that's been done in terms of miniaturization in the time since?
Okay. And just want to mention to you that you're listening to KFJC 89.7, Los Altos Hills. We're probably going to take a break in just a couple of minutes. We're going to read, I think, one more short article, and then we are going to take a brief break. Anyway, continuing on from where we controlled, RHIC is a very simple, albeit fiendish, combination of two known scientific tools joined in a sophisticated modification to produce a theoretically predictable result. RHIC is one procedure that can explain the events in Dallas. The questions in rebuttal to this stand come quickly to mind. Quote, can anyone, using RHIC or not, be hypnotized to commit a criminal act so brutal as murder? Isn't it true that one will not perform any act under hypnosis that one wouldn't in a perfectly uncontrolled state? The answer is simply no, Lawrence writes. Dr. Theodore Barber of Harvard University in the Journal of Psychology states that a good subject will commit antisocial or dangerous acts if first convinced by the hypnotist that his behavior is normal and proper. Such acts as one account of Dr. Barber's work puts it, as throwing acid at the experimenter. Quote, two recent extensive reviews of this problem have not failed to note that since the good subject accepts the hypnotist's words as a true statement, an unscrupulous hypnotist can induce the subject to commit antisocial acts, unquote. Again, the skeptic's retort may be all very well to theorize, but has it ever been proven that a person under hypnosis will actually do these things? The answer is an unqualified yes. Under the hypnotic spell of Bjorn Sjo Nielsen, 28-year-old Polly Hardrup walked alone into a bank in a suburb of Copenhagen in March of 1951. In the course of a holdup that Sjo Nielsen had, quote, controlled him to carry out, he calmly shot two bank employees to death. When he was caught, Hardrup confessed that he had done the killings under hypnosis. Tried in 1954, Hardrup was found guilty of manslaughter because he was hypnotized, quote, in a state of mental abnormality, unquote, and was committed to prison, to a prison mental institution. Sjo Nielsen was also convicted of, Nielsen was also convicted of manslaughter. Quote, through having planned and by various means, including hypnosis, instigated Hardrup of the crimes, unquote. He was given a life term. The fact that hypnosis was the tool of control was established by Dr. Paul J. Reiter, one of Denmark's leading psychiatrists and an expert in hypnosis. Okay, well, in the next section of the broadcast, we're going to examine this concept even more closely, because this is a sticking point for a lot of people. A lot of people refuse to believe that somebody can be hypnotized into performing an antisocial act, even presuming that they could be hypnotized in the first place and activated to perform some act from a distance. We are going to be examining that at greater length, and we're going to be getting into some nitty-gritty stuff and some very complicated but very fascinating case histories of a couple of people. So don't go away. That'll be coming up in about 4 or 5 minutes when we return. And then after we finish that segment, we may be going fairly soon after that to the telephone. So stay tuned. This is Nip Tuck. Dave Emery and I will be back with the next section of Radio Free America following this short. Okay. Anyway, starting the second half then, and you remember we just had left off there with a discussion of, among other things, the possibility of the radio hypnosis, radio-induced hypnosis being used to force people to commit antisocial acts. And in fact, the question of whether one could credibly say that people could commit antisocial acts under the influence of hypnosis if they were not inclined to commit these kind of acts in regular life.
Now, reviewing very briefly what we've been looking at so far, after a couple of very interesting articles suggesting, in which people suggested that they had been placed under mind control and had surgical implants which were controlling their thoughts, we took a look first of all at a fellow by the name of Jose Delgado, who had patterned a technique to control behavior of animals and perhaps humans through the use of electrical implants in the brain. And we took a look at the fact that his work was subsidized by the Office of Naval Research and the U.S. Office of Aeromedical Research. We also took a look at the fact that it appears that his research was done well before the time which he or journalists reported that it was done. And also at the fact that Mr. Delgado is of a rather authoritarian frame of mind, in that he does not feel that people have the right to control their own minds, okay? That, in other words, man does not have the right to develop his own mind. Then we took a look at the development of a technique which has been in operation for quite some time called RHICEDOM, Radio Hypnotic Intracerebral Control, Electronic Dissolution of Memory. Now, RHIC basically entails hypnotizing someone to perform a given action, then implanting a small electrical device in a muscle, which would cause the muscle to twitch. When that muscle twitches, the person is conditioned to reinforce their will to perform the act which they have been hypnotized to perform. EDOM involves basically using radio waves to stimulate the production of acetylcholine, which is a neural transmitter which basically permits a nerve impulse to travel across the synapse, the gap between two nerve cells. If anybody would like to ask us a question about exactly how that works, we can read you some of the text from Were We Controlled. It's extremely technical, so I thought we thought really that it might be best to let go because it'll sound kind of like some gobbledygook on the air. But if you would like us to go into it, we'll do the best we can. It's extremely technical, and for that reason and the fact that it probably would not be terribly comprehensible over the radio, we elected to sort of let that slide. But there is a very detailed and, technical discussion in Were We Controlled as to exactly how that was done. So the technology, RHICEDOM, basically permits someone to hypnotize somebody to perform an action and to then reinforce the will to perform that action by remote control. EDOM enables them, again, by remote control, to basically erase someone's time sense by blocking neural transmitters in the brain. Again, too much acetylcholine, apparently, functions just like the too many cars on a freeway. It blocks traffic. Now, one question that has consistently come up and is the fact that is the question of whether or not someone can be hypnotized to perform an action which they would not normally do. Many critics who have suggested that mind control is impossible have cited the allegation that someone cannot be hypnotized into doing something they would not ordinarily do as a means of rebutting the notion that mind control is possible. Well, we're going to be going to read you a section now from a book called Operation Mind Control. Operation Mind Control was published in softcover by Dell Books, and it's authored by Walter Bowart, B-O-W-A-R-T. As I said, published by Dell Books, copyrighted 1978. And what Bowart points out here is the fact that although someone might not be able to be hypnotized into doing something, say shooting someone that they would that they like, say someone would not even under hypnosis be could not be convinced to shoot someone that they normally held in high regard, they most definitely could be convinced under hypnosis that this person is in fact somebody else who they would shoot, and then the person will go ahead and shoot them. And that's important to remember. You may not be able to be hypnotized into shooting your mother, but you could be convinced that your mother was in fact someone else who you would be quite willing to shoot, and who you would then go ahead and shoot. Again, reading from Operation Mind Control, Walter Bowart, copyrighted 1978. In 1947, J.G. Watkins induced criminal behavior in deeply hypnotized subjects during an army experiment. Watkins suggested a distorted view of reality to his subjects by inducing hallucinations, which allowed them to avoid direct conflict with their own moral concepts. He carefully chose his suggestions to be in line with his subjects' pre-existing motivational structures, and so was able to induce so-called antisocial behavior. Watkins took a normal, healthy army private, a young man whose tests indicated a most stable personality, and put him in a deep trance. Though merely striking a superior officer is a court-martial offense in the army, Watkins wanted to see if he could get his subject to strangle a high-ranking officer. After the subject was deep into trance, Watkins told him that the officer sitting across from him was a Japanese soldier who was trying to kill him. Interrupting, keep in mind this is 1947, right after World War II. He must kill or be killed, Watkins suggested. And immediately the private leapt ferociously at the officer and grabbed him by the throat. In his waking state, the private would have been aghast at the thought of trying to strangle a superior officer. But under hypnosis, believing the officer was a dangerous Japanese soldier, the young private had to be pulled off his superior by three husky assistants. The officer came within a hair's breadth of being strangled, as the young man was most persistent in his attempt to kill what he regarded as the enemy. Watkins repeated this experiment with other subjects. The second time, he used two officers who were good friends. One of them was given the hypnotic suggestion that the other was a Japanese soldier and that he must kill or be killed. The man who had received the command not only made a powerful lunge at his friend, but as he did, he whipped out and opened a concealed jackknife, which neither the doctor, his assistants, nor his friend knew he had. Only the quick action of one of his assistants, who was a judo expert, prevented a potentially fatal stabbing. In both cases, reality was so distorted that the subjects took murderous and antisocial action. If they had accomplished their defensive acts, unquote, both men could have been convicted of murder since the law did not recognize motivation through hypnosis as a fact. The courts, in all but a few cases, had adopted the traditional scientific view that criminal behavior cannot be induced under hypnosis. That view still stands today. To test the premise, which was then widely held, that a normal person under hypnotic trance could not be made to divulge information which would be self-incriminating, Watkins conducted a number of experiments where a monetary bribe was offered to withhold information. Watkins discovered that, quote, when placed in a trance, they spilled every time, either verbally or in writing. The subject of one of these experiments was an enlisted WAC in military intelligence. Her commanding officer ordered her not to reveal a list of what were made to appear to be real military secrets. Under hypnosis, she spilled everything. So basically, summing up here, this fellow J.G. Watkins, first of all, hypnotized a soldier into believing that his superior officer was a Japanese soldier whom he then proceeded to try to strangle. He then hypnotized him to think that one of his friends, an actual friend of his, was a Japanese soldier. A different fellow then pulled out a knife and attempted to kill his friend. And apparently people who were conditioned to not disclose information could be induced under hypnosis to spill all of that information. So again, keep in mind that it is possible to get someone to think that reality is other than what it really is and act on the basis of a false concept, and that is how someone can be hypnotized into doing something that they would not do when in a normal state of consciousness.
All right, continuing from Bullard's book on a new chapter and on a rather interesting series of revelations of fairly recent vintage. This is just starting at the beginning of Bullard's book, Chapter 11, A School for Assassins. The author writes as follows. The cryptocracy, and by the cryptocracy, Bullard is referring to the people at the top of various intelligence groups interested in this sort of secretive behavior in terms of experimental mind control. So he's using it as a generic term. It doesn't have any specific significance to any specific people. The cryptocracy recruited their assassins from among people who had already demonstrated a violent nature, people who had few reservations about taking human life. No homicidal maniacs were recruited because they could not be controlled. The cryptocracy needed killers who would not murder on impulse, but only upon command. Once selected, the assassin candidates were turned over to the military, where, under the guise of, quote, combat readiness training, they underwent a complete program of conditioning. Graduates of the program would forever after act with ruthless efficiency. They would eliminate local political leaders in a foreign country, or undertake search and destroy missions in violation of national and international laws. They would be given the cover that would allow them to enter the foreign service, or they would pose as embassy marine guards. In July 1975, the Sunday Times in London quoted a U.S. Navy psychologist who admitted that U.S. naval intelligence, and I just interrupting for a moment, you'll remember that U.S. naval intelligence was one of the groups earlier that was funding Delgado's research, as well as other mind control research. The U.S. Navy psychologist who admitted that U.S. naval intelligence had taken convicted murderers from military prisons, conditioned them as political assassins, and then placed them in American embassies around the world. This admission came shortly after the Senate Intelligence Committee had scolded the CIA for plotting a number of political assassinations around the world. From the congressional reports, however, one got the feeling that the cryptocracy was being chastised not for the assassinations it had successfully accomplished, but for those which it had attempted but failed. The attempts on the life of Fidel Castro drew the greatest notice from the congressional committees and the press. According to the Sunday Times story, naval psychologist Lieutenant Commander Thomas Narutt, N-A-R-U-T, was assigned to the U.S. Regional Medical Center at Naples, Italy. When he first made public the Navy's part in programming assassins, he was attending a NATO conference in Oslo on dimensions of stress and anxiety. In attendance at that conference were 120 psychologists of all descriptions and from many countries. Many of them were involved in research on how to improve man's ability to cope with stress, but none of them felt compelled, as Narut did, to discuss their work so fully or so frankly. The stated objective of the conference was to exchange information on how soldiers and people in difficult jobs could cope with stress. Dr. Narut's talk was on, quote, the use of a symbolic model and verbal intervention in inducing and reducing stress. His speech began with a plug for the Navy. He knew, he said, that many of the scientists present had often encountered problems in their purely scientific research because of the military's inclination to research that would yield quick and useful results. He sympathized with those who had trouble getting subjects, funds, or both out of the military for their purely scientific research. But things were different in the Navy, he said. In the Navy, Narut bragged, there were plenty of captive personnel who could be used as guinea pigs. In the Navy, there was a computerized record of each man's background and psychological profile, so that a quick selection of men with suitable psychological inclinations for experiments could be made. Navy psychologists not only had access to computerized records, but also to psychological tests and background data on a large number of people. In the Navy, Narut said, funds were plentiful and there were no problems with transporting subjects for study to nearly any place in the world. Narut stated proudly that the U.S. Navy provided scientists with the most advanced research facilities in the world. A Canadian psychologist at the conference later remarked, Narut's message was loud and clear, join the Navy and study the world. In his brief discourse, Dr. Narut did no more than hint at the work he had been doing in teaching, quote, combat readiness units to cope with the stress of killing. Later, however, during private questioning with a small group of listeners, reporter Peter Watson of the Sunday Times, a former psychologist among them, Narut in full unfolded the amazing story of the Navy's programming of assassins on an assembly line basis. In his mid-30s, Dr. Narut had just completed his doctoral dissertation on the question of whether certain films provoke anxiety, and whether forcing a man to do irrelevant tasks while watching violent films would help him cope with the anxiety they produced. When pressed by Watson to explain the details of this kind of conditioning, Narut said that he had worked with, quote, combat readiness units, which included men being programmed for commando-type operations and for undercover placement at U.S. embassies. These, Narut said, were, quote, hitmen and assassins, Narut's own words, made ready to kill in selected countries should the need arise. Dr. Alfred Zitani, an American delegate to the conference, was very surprised by Narut's disclosure. Quote, do you think Dr. Narut realizes what he has just said? Zitani asked. That kind of information must be classified.
The conditioning of Narut's assassins was accomplished by audio-visual desensitization, a standard behavior modification process. These men were desensitized, unquote, to mayhem by being shown films of people being killed or injured in a number of different ways. At first, the films would show only mild forms of bloodshed. As the men became acclimated to the scenes of carnage, they would see progressively more violent scenes. The assassin candidates, Narut explained, would eventually be able to dissociate any feelings they might have from even the goriest scenes they viewed. Narut said that, of course, U.S. naval psychologists would have first selected the candidates for training by their psychological makeup. Those selected for assassination assignments were often from submarine crews and paratroops. Others were convicted murderers from military prisons who had already shown a proclivity for violence. Still others were men who had been given awards for valor. World War II Medal of Honor winner Audie Murphy was a subject of extensive research. The best killers, according to Narut, were men whom psychologists would classify as passive-aggressive, unquote, personalities. These were people with strong drives that were usually kept under tight control. Such types were usually calm, but from time to time would exhibit outbursts of temper during which they could literally kill without remorse. Narut said that through psychological testing, He and his colleagues were looking for more such men for further conditioning. Among the tests used by the Navy to determine violent natures was the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, which is used widely by educators and businessmen to determine psychological qualities of students and employees. The tests consist of hundreds of questions designed to measure such personality traits as hostility, depression, and psychopathy. According to Narut, the men selected by the tests or by evidence of past violence were taken for programming to the Navy's Neuropsychiatric Laboratory in San Diego, California, or to the Naples Medical Center, which employed Dr. Narut. Audiovisual desensitization was the major technique used in programming the assassins. Psychological indoctrination completed the programming by instilling the desired prejudicial attitudes. The audiovisual desensitization began with the subject strapped into a chair with his head clamped so that he could not look away from the screen. A special mechanism prevented the subject's eyelids from closing. The candidate was then shown a film of an African youth being crudely circumcised by fellow members of his tribe. The youth was circumcised with a blunt knife, painfully and without anesthetic. This well-known film is used widely in psychological experiments to create stress. Afterwards, the candidate was asked about details of what he had seen. He was asked, for example, to describe the color of the belt on the doctor's trousers or the motif on the handle of the knife that cut off the foreskin. The next film showed a man in a sawmill where planks were sliced from huge logs. In the operation of the saw, the man slipped and cut off his fingers. As the films progressed in gruesomeness, the reactions of the candidate were measured by sensing devices. Heartbeat, breathing rate, and brain waves were recorded, very much as on a polygraph. That, of course, is a lie detector interrupting here. If the physiological responses, which might have been great in the beginning, slowed down and resumed normal patterns as the more bloodthirsty scenes were viewed, the candidates were judged to have completed this stage of conditioning.
Continuing on with Boehrert's Operation Mind Control, the last phase of conditioning, Narut said, was to indoctrinate the candidates to think of their potential enemies as inferior forms of life. By this stage, the candidates would have already been selected for assignment to particular countries. They would be shown films and given lectures which portrayed the customs and cultural habits of the foreign countries in a biased fashion. The people of those countries would be portrayed as enemies of the United States and were always spoken of in demeaning terms. They were often presented as if they were, quote, less than human. Their customs were ridiculed, and local leaders were presented as evil demagogues, even if they were legitimate political figures. According to Dr. Narut, it took only a few weeks to indoctrinate susceptible candidates by this process. Those who were not susceptible to the conditioning were dropped earlier in the program and returned to other assignments. Narut admitted that he did not have the necessary, quote, need to know as to where all the programmed men were sent, although at one point in his conversation with Peter Watson, Narut specified that programmed assassins have been installed in the Athens embassy. He said that his busiest time was when a large group of men went through such training towards the end of 1973, at the time of the Yom Kippur War. After the Oslo conference interview, Watson returned to London to file his story. Watson is the reporter for the Times and a former psychologist himself. Watson returned to London to file his story. Writing up the details, he found a few points which needed clarification, but he could not reach Narut either at his home or in his laboratory in Naples. Watson then asked the U.S. Embassy in London to comment on the information Narut had volunteered. The embassy passed the buck to the U.S. Navy. Within a few days, the Pentagon issued a categorical denial that the U.S. Navy had ever, quote, engaged in psychological training or other types of training of personnel as assassins. Quote, they also denied that any such training had ever taken place either in San Diego or in Naples. They said they, too, had been unable to contact Lieutenant Commander Narut, but they did confirm that he was on the staff of the U.S. Regional Medical Center in Naples as a psychologist. But Dr. Zitani later offered to testify about what Narut had told him to, quote, appropriate authorities. Watson was also approached later by a psychologist in Los Angeles who said he had seen the Pentagon denials, so thought Watson would like to know that he had lent the San Diego psychologist a copy of his film on circumcision, which was used in the desensitization conditioning. A few days later, Narut was located. He flew to London to discuss the matter, ostensibly with Watson's paper, the Sunday Times, but instead he held a press conference, saying only that he had been talking in, quote, theoretical and not practical terms. He then flew back to the Naples base. After his return to Naples, U.S. Naval headquarters in London offered the official explanation for Narut's statement. Narut had, quote, personal problems. A few days later, Watson was able to contact Narut at the U.S. hospital in Naples, but he refused to elaborate on his disclosure. During the Oslo conference interview, Narut had said several times that what he was saying about the assassins was, quote, coming out anyway. He was referring to the congressional disclosures about CIA assassination plots. But the fact that the Navy had been operating along lines similar to the CIA was not known to the public, nor has it subsequently been admitted. The details of the story that Lieutenant Commander Narut related have been strongly and categorically denied in all subsequent queries of the Navy. So, looking back, there's a variety of interesting things in the Narut story. Some of this we're not going to have time to cash in on tonight in terms of bringing up supporting documentation that goes with it. But the ascending series of desensitizations. Now you notice in this there isn't even any mention of use of drugs or anything else. So this is either possibly a different type of training, or it's possible that those details were omitted, or that that's a later stage of conditioning, or something like that. It's possible, as they mentioned, that this Dr. Narut did not have need to know authority to see the whole operation all the way through. Anyway, it touches on some other interesting things that we've seen in other places that we may have time to talk about later on.
Again, the processes involved here are very, very common processes, which anybody who's ever studied psychology in any university in the United States would be familiar with. First of all, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory is something which probably a lot of you have taken. It's a very commonly used test, and it's administered in institutions of all kinds, okay? The desensitization process, audiovisual desensitization, is also, as indicated, a very, very common technique. There's been a lot of research in classical psychology tests about eliminating phobias using that precise technique. Well, in this case, in a sense, a phobia, namely the phobia of extreme physical violence, is what is being removed. Note also that the people are already inclined in that direction, the people selected as candidates for this thing. I think it's also worth noting that despite what I think one could regard as the pro forma denials of the Navy, the source for this information is the London Times. It's one of the most respected newspapers in the world. It's also quite conservative. Many people think, for example, the New York Times, which has a liberal reputation. The London Times is a pretty conservative and very respectable newspaper, so this is not National Enquirer affair. And Narut's story, by the way, has been printed in a lot of other publications. Now, keep in mind that Delgado's work, for example, was funded by the Office of Naval Research. It's, again, not only was the CIA involved in developing mind control techniques, and specifically mind control techniques to perform assassination, but the military as well. And keep all of that in front of you. You know, remember all of that as we go through this. And again, go back and put some of these details together. But as with RHIC, in which the commonly used technique of post-hypnotic blocking, the technique of conditioning, in this case a Pavlovian conditioning, was used. Operant conditioning can also be used in certain methods of having people commit assassination. The difference between those can be discussed in a phone-in session, if you'd like. But again, the techniques that are involved here are very, very common, and would certainly be familiar to anyone with even a relatively elementary knowledge of academic psychology. Now, keep in mind Lincoln Lawrence's account, basically, of mind control being used in the assassination of President Kennedy. We're going to go back to a CIA assassin. Now, we're going to read you an entire chapter from Bowert's book, and this is almost certainly the most detailed and complete account of the functioning of a mind control assassin ever presented. And because of that, we're going to read you the entire chapter unedited so that basically you'll have all of the information at your disposal and can go back and check it out. And I think, again, the time during which mind control has been in effect is worth taking note of here. The techniques which we were talking about with RHICEDOM were fully operational by the mid-1960s. Mind control zombie couriers were testified, their existence circa World War II was testified by William Stevenson, a very high-ranking British intelligence agent, in fact, in charge of all British intelligence in the Americas during World War II. So keep in mind, now the fellow we're going to be talking about here, a fellow named Luis Angel Castillo, was basically the events we're about to describe here, or rather that Bowert relates in Operation Mind Control, occurred in 1967, okay, almost 20 years ago. And note the degree of sophistication here in the conditioning. Now, Bowert titles this chapter The Four Faces of a Zombie, and it begins. On March 2nd, 1967, 24-year-old Luis Angel Castillo was arrested by the Philippine National Bureau of Investigation, the NBI, on suspicion of conspiring to assassinate President Ferdinand Marcos in Manila. In a series of interrogation sessions, the NBI and the Philippine Army investigators gave him truth serum at his request and put him under hypnosis. During one of these sessions, Castillo revealed that he had been involved in an assassination 4 years earlier. Castillo told the NBI, both under hypnosis and truth serum, and also in a normal state, that he had been hypnoprogrammed to kill a man riding in an open car. Although Castillo did not know the identity of his target, the scene of his supposed hit was in Dallas, Texas. The date was November 22, 1963. After revealing this information, Castillo asked for political asylum in Manila. He was quoted in the Manila Times as saying, quote, "I am afraid to go anywhere anyway. I am as good as dead now," unquote. "I don't know how I got into Dallas and how I got out," Castillo told reporters, "but I am sure I did not carry a gun." The Manila Times story reported that Castillo had arrived in Manila carrying a Philippine passport which identified him as Antonio Reyes Elorriaga, E-L-O-R-I-A-G-A, a returning resident who had been expelled from America for overstaying his visa and stealing a car. Castillo, by the way, is C-A-S-T-I-L-L-O. While in the U.S., Castillo had traveled under the aliases Angelo Rodriguez, Razo Hernandez, Mario Rodriguez, Ignacio Gonzalez, Gradieda, and Antonio Elorriaga. Castillo told investigators that a woman with a German accent, a Mrs. Krebs, had given him his initial instructions in Dallas. According to Castillo, she was just one of many individuals who worked on him to place him in a deep hypnotic trance for the Kennedy job. Castillo said that he had been a private in the Cuban militia, the Segunda Organización Defensiva in Santiago, Cuba, when he was initially chosen for training in espionage work. He was subsequently trained for the Defensiva under a Colonel Calma, C-A-L-M-A, at a camp located about 15 miles from the Bay of Pigs. Among the members of the training cadre, Castillo said, were a communications expert named Karnovsky, along with some other Cubans and a handful of Americans. One American he identified was James Smith, who attended to Castillo's needs both as a civilian in Cuba and later in the United States. 3 years later, on October 2, 1966, Castillo was arrested in New Mexico and charged with driving without a proper auto registration. His arrest was made under the Elorriaga identity. Castillo was brought before New Mexico Justice of the Peace Elmer Bassett and sentenced to 4 days in jail. "The reason I gave him a jail sentence," Bassett said, "was I figured when a fellow has a hard time remembering what his name is, there's something wrong with him," unquote. After serving his sentence, Castillo was turned over to U.S. immigration authorities because he had no proof of U.S. citizenship. Bassett reported that, quote, "Castillo said he was from Madison, Wisconsin, but was born in the Philippines. He couldn't show that he was from the Philippines or that he wasn't," unquote. Bassett also revealed that someone had called him a few hours after Castillo had appeared before him and asked that the man be released, unquote. "I don't know who it was," Bassett said. "I just told him I couldn't do that," unquote. And Niptuck will continue with the Castillo story.
According to the NBI, which again is the Philippine Bureau of Investigation, the Filipino FBI, Castillo had Antonio Elorriaga's Philippine passport on his person when he was arrested in Manila. Based on information provided by the intelligence service of the Philippine Armed Forces, the NBI had been searching for him since February. They had evidence that Castillo, in the guise of Elorriaga, had made contact with a guerrilla group that was constantly plotting to assassinate Marcos and overthrow the Philippine government. The NBI set to work grilling their captured suspect. They knew something of his criminal past. They knew, for example, that he had been arrested in 1962 for carrying a concealed weapon. They also knew that 2 years later he had been sentenced to a state reformatory in Bordentown, New Jersey, for larceny. But nothing prepared them for the shocking story implicating him in the events of Dallas. They asked Castillo to submit to a lie detector test, and were surprised when he said that he preferred truth serum. Suspicious of both his strange story and his behavior, NBI officials called in a psychiatrist to examine him. But even after the psychiatrist judged Castillo normal, the NBI investigators still refused to take Castillo's bizarre and contradictory story at face value. Later, reporters connected with the Manila Times were equally dumbfounded by Castillo's strange behavior. One reporter described him as, quote, a now talkative, now reticent cloak and dagger man. He clammed up when he was asked whether he was in the Philippines to help implement an assassination plot against President Marcos. In his truth serum statement, he claimed he had worked with a, quote, cell of reds, unquote, to end someone's life. But during his interview with the press, he said, quote, neither do I admit or deny it. When quizzed about Lee Harvey Oswald, he drew a blank. As a member of the Warren Commission, Gerald Ford was queried by the Philippine authorities about Castillo's revelations concerning the JFK assassination. Ford said that he would not comment on the Castillo story until he had more information. A spokesman for the Dallas Police Department said that they had no record on Castillo. Nevertheless, the U.S. Embassy did agree to a closed-door meeting between embassy officials and NBI Director Serafin Fausto on the subject of Castillo. After the meeting, Fausto refused to comment further on the story, but he did tell reporters that, quote, although publication of the story has prejudiced investigation of the case, one good thing has come out of it. Needed information is coming in from the United States to shed light on the case. Fausto also made it clear that leads obtained from the U.S. Embassy justified continuing the investigation of Castillo's link to the assassination of President Kennedy. After making an official request for assistance from the FBI, the NBI clamped a news blackout on the story, and nothing further was published in the press. Private investigations later revealed that Castillo was spirited out of the Philippines, but not before a series of hypnotic sessions had taken place at the request of the FBI. The FBI wanted to have Castillo, while under hypnosis, place the time of the Kennedy assassination. They wanted to know when Castillo had come to Dallas, what time he arrived at the building, and from what location he was supposed to shoot. They wanted to know the time he left the building, the names of any people involved, and any information by which might indicate how the plot was hatched and by whom. It came as a surprise to the NBI that the FBI also wanted Castillo questioned about the Boyeros Airport, 8 miles south of Havana, Cuba. The FBI requested that the tightest possible security be kept on any testimony obtained from the hypnotic sessions. In the last of three sessions requested by the FBI, Castillo was induced into deep hypnotic trance by the ordinary talking method in an NBI interrogation room in Manila. While in that trance state, he was questioned for more than 3.5 hours. Now Dave will continue.